My name is Amanda.
And so schedule
15 years ago, I started a computer game called Fracadia. Now, the computer game had no hit points and no skills. All you could do was chat. And you could make your little guy walk around. So it's a top-down view. You were seeing your small person like an eagle's eye view. But I learned one thing, and that is when you can move around your pawn, there's something in the human mind that makes it feel like it's a part of you. If you've ever driven a car, and you get the sense that the car's bumpers are like your shoulders, this ability of the human being to extend into what they're moving around is a property that's kind of new to our society. And I'm going to talk in these fancy words. And really, role-playing games belong in the area of the arts. They partly go into literature, but they partly go into philosophy. But we don't talk much about the philosophy. Philosophy is not quite a science yet. It's kind of putting all the ideas on the table. Where's the science in collecting everything you've thought about? Well, that's not science. It's like a library isn't science. A library is collecting all the scrolls and then the tablets and then the books. Well, philosophy is kind of like that. It's not really a science. It's an art. But out of this art is growing some science. Let me diverge into the philosophy of very basic reasoning. Our species is going through, here's another fancy word, our species is going through a paradigm shift. Once upon a time, everybody lived by rules. Somewhere along the way, probably around the Golden Age of Greece, someone got the realization, we don't really live by rules, we live by principles. Now, a principle is like a rule in that it's something you're supposed to follow. Brush your teeth before you go to bed is a rule. You're always supposed to do that. Well, it's acceptable to break a principle when it's for the sake of another principle more important in that situation. Now, all along in the history of humankind, we would come up with some pretty great rules, but then we would find places where you're not supposed to follow them. Like, always brush your teeth. Well, what if you don't have teeth? What is the point of brushing your teeth if you don't have teeth? There are always going to be places where a rule doesn't fit. No rule is so perfect that you can't think of a situation where another thing would be probably the right thing to do. It depends on the situation. And really, if you're not considering the situation, you're probably not considering which thing to follow. Now, bringing that into role-playing games and storytelling games, they've got principles too. When I was playing Fracadia, there were players who wanted to play Dungeons & Dragons, which has lots and lots of rules. And when you play Dungeons & Dragons, one person comes up with the story, and the other people are sitting around trying to figure out what to do. One person's building the puzzle, and the other people are trying to solve it. And the reason that they wanted to do this is that the kind of role-playing they were doing is what I came to call strict role-playing, where you have a time period. You're not allowed to make a character with a machine gun in Dungeons & Dragons, for example. It's strict. And what is it strict compared to? Well, the first kind of role-playing you probably did was running around the house saying, I'm fill in the blank. And the very first thing you do when you role-play is pick who would you like to be. And very often it's some kind of hero. Well, the most primitive kind of hero is a hero because they win. This used to mystify me when I was a kid. I used to read and hear the stories of Heracles, of Hercules. The very first story of Hercules is, once upon a time, there was a baby, and some snakes tried to kill him, and he killed the snakes. The end. There's not much moral dilemma here. There's no challenge. He's a hero because he wins, and our first hero stories were probably the stories of our victories, the stories where something went really right. And I think we're in those first days of storytelling games, because a lot of storytelling games are very focused on how do you win. And ironically, in the storytelling games, they tend not to have what the strict role-playing games have. They have shared control of the game world. Jumping back into the strict role-playing, it became clear in Fracadia, where you can build your own area and you can say who gets to stay and who has to go, it became very clear that there had to be a cordoned off, like a secure airlock system, to make sure only those people who opted in to playing with the more complicated set of rules would go in there. If you go past this door and you are playing Yu-Gi-Oh, then the concepts from Star Trek don't really belong. Hello? If I want to roleplay a Vulcan, maybe that is not the place for me. And when the Vulcan walks in to the Yu-Gi-Oh world, they're eroding something that has grown up in that little chamber called continuity. Now, one of the main principles of strict role-playing is in-character actions lead to in-character consequences. What happened in the past shapes the present, and what happens in the present gives birth to the future. It makes a lot of sense. But over in the persona role-play areas, which were had less of an airlock, were more free-form role-play, what happened in the past was very malleable. A lot of people on Fracadia, I have to admit it, they do erotic role-play. And when they do this role-playing, what happened in a game last week, they're very comfortable with disregarding it. It's like every game, they imagine a past, but there's not really a past. It's like a reboot every time. And persona roleplay fulfills fantasy better. There are a lot of fantasies that don't work when you try to keep them going. Suppose your fantasy is, I want to meet someone while speed dating and have them turn out to be the love of my life. Well, it's a nice story, and you may find someone else who wants to play that story with you. But once you've played that story, it's done. And not as many people want to play the fantasy of, we lived happily ever after and nothing much happened. And that's kind of what a lot of the story gaming has gotten to, is starting the story but not going past it. One of my favorite storytelling games is Fiasco. Fiasco is a game about making a story that resembles those movies where lots of things go wrong, like the Coen brothers. If you can imagine a Raising Arizona movie, that's kind of what that family of role-playing games is like. And I'm telling you about this thing about principles and rules, because now I want to talk about two of my favorite principles of being a game master of the strict kind of role-playing games. We'll get back to the storytelling games too. When I run a role-play game, I see myself as having two jobs. I call them the genie and the meanie. The genie grants wishes. You're there to entertain your friends. Your friends come in. If you're playing villains and vigilantes, their wish is to fly, to be super strong, to be wonderfully beautiful. Or some players have a fantasy to have a horrible life. There's what Aaron Alston, may he rest in peace, dubbed the masochist. This is a player whose favorite thing is to have everything go wrong for them. They, if it's a lady, she may want to play Cinderella before Cinderella gets the glass slippers. If it's a guy, he may want to play, my parents were killed, I'm afflicted with the plague, I'm Thomas Covenant, I've got leprosy. And this is the fellow who, when he rolls that fumble in Dungeons and Dragons, or that fumble table, yay, I've lost a leg. My character's more tragic than ever. So the genie part is very, very interesting. You get to know your players and you get to find out what they hope for. Now the meanie, here's some more philosophy. Who was it that said, life without pain has no meaning? It's Nietzsche. Well, the game master is about to fill your lives with lots of meaning. I remember these things because game master, GM, also starts with G and M, genie and meanie. And for the players to have fun, a good story probably balances some good things and some bad things. But when I'm playing on Furcadia, there were originally no dice. And when I tried to adapt traditional role-playing to a chat room with little pawns, I found out that I was handing out penalties, and the fights were something like this. I try to hit the dragon with my sword, and now I'm the narrator. You miss, the dragon bites you, you're in terrible pain, and now you're on your side clutching your guts. This is not fun. But worse than not fun, I've put myself in an adversarial position. I am against the players. But I'm not supposed to be just the meanie, I'm also supposed to be the genie. So that's one reason we can have dice. Dice are the shield. The GM screen is not my shield. The dice are my real shield. It's not me doing this to you. You've rolled some dice. The game did this to you. And folks who have never done this before are not familiar with how your character sheet establishes a piece of continuity of what your character, who your character is supposed to be. If your character is an illiterate orphan, they don't necessarily know how to read. If your character is a 100-pound weakling with physical disabilities, maybe they're not going to chase the criminal over that 12-foot chain link fence. And this pleases role players to no end. That continuity has been appeased, fulfilled, its validity. But to someone not familiar with this, it's arbitrary. You've rolled a number on a dice, and your future was determined by chance? Well, no. If you're a story gamer, what's new to you perhaps is it's chance mixed with these rules that help the continuity fulfill itself. And when you choose your persona, when you choose your character, you sort of make a bargain with everyone else at the table that you're going to do something more interesting than what is most optimal. And so the later role-playing games, you could make a point-constructed character, you could take a disability or an emotional quirk or even a kind of an insanity in exchange for some other advantage. And this works really well online because when players go through a character generation system, they realize that everyone there has paid this same price. With no rules, I can make my character the Mary Sue type character with every possible advantage and no disadvantages. But if I go through a nice character generation system that understands that the variety would be good for the drama of the overall game, I may choose to have my character be wonderfully attractive. It's a very common Mary Sue trait. But then give my character a quirk like my character has no short-term memory, like the character Dory in Finding Nemo. Or I may give my character a disability like the Cardinal's spies are after me because I'm suspected of being a heretic. One of the first games I ever played that did this was called Flashing Blades. It was by FGU, and it was role-playing in the 1600s. It's the Musketeers game. And the continuity here is historical. Now, one reason that I tend to favor strict role-playing games with the dice kind is that I like that kind of story where continuity is a really big deal. But I also like it because part of continuity is real world history sometimes, or real world geography. I was talking to Lisa, one of the con directors, and she was talking about McDonald Observatory, where she and her husband happened to go in Texas. I'm living in Texas now. And she happened to go there, and she said, it's beautiful. There's a visitor center. There's a road up a mountain. And I knew what she was talking about, not because I had actually been there, but because a friend of mine named Matt had run a role-playing game of superheroes, and he had set the game at McDonald Observatory. He had gone online and found a map and hijacked this map to be the location for his game. Role-playing games, if you want to opt in to doing this, can take you places. And it's harder for story games to do this. It doesn't mean they can't. It just means that the folks who are making it don't happen to be thinking about that yet. It's not a rule that a game has to have a set location. Part of the beauty of a storytelling game can be it's improv, and we made the location up to suit us as we needed it. It was fast, it was quick. But one of the principles of strict role-playing is once you've set something down in the story, it's kind of sealed and set in stone. It becomes part of continuity. And as the players themselves go on to have their characters do things, if the characters do things that are noteworthy or influential, what the characters do meant something? Well, Nietzsche was partly right. Life without pain has no meaning. But the reason we run into pain very often is that we are trying to do things that change the world around us or even the universe. And the word meaning is something is going to affect the future. If I'm playing the Three Musketeers game and my companion dies on the battlefield, it's meaningful because I can roleplay the sorrow of having lost the fellow who mentored me through the Academy of the Musketeers. But it's also meaningful because when we play the next game, we're not going to have his amazing sword skill and his agility on our side. There's been a meaningful loss to the potential of what's going to happen as a result of that character. So it's a principle that pain adds meaning to life, but it's also a principle that the reason that it does so is that the meanings of lives are future implications. And the storytelling games tend to have less of an accent on this. We get together and we play a more casual form. It can be more relaxing. Strict role-playing games can be very stressy as we make a replica of a castle and we're thinking about, well, how would you have assaulted it back then with this many men and a catapult, four teams with ladders, but no petards? I'm giving an example from the Musketeers game. And where it's taken me in role-playing games just recently is this. This is a map of a ship called La Belle. It sank in the 1600s, and it's one of the few shipwrecks that we have that we've brought the entire ship up, or what's left of it. It sank about 300 years ago, and the pieces we had were so intact that I was able to make this map from the maps made by the archaeologists. And so my hobby has taken me someplace historical. My interest has been piqued because I'm thinking about running around with swords and muskets. And in order to do that more authentically, I'm doing real research. Now, the La Belle, that's redundant, La means the, La Belle is about 50 feet long. She's 49 feet long. A piece of 8.5 by 11 paper has just enough of a margin that if I make that in the standard miniature scale of 1 inch is 5 feet, La Belle just happens to fit on one piece of paper when you go to a copy center and say, here, print this file out for me. Well, it's fun to do role-playing in real life, but I also play role-playing games with experimental archaeologists. There's things that you will get insight from it if you put yourself in the mind and the body of someone back then. When I made the map of the hold, I wanted to duplicate, because it's fun, all the barrels and boxes that were in the shipwreck. It had settled so slowly that there was very little rearrangement. The ropes were still in place that bound everything where it was going to be. And as I was making this map, it became very apparent to me that the front half of the ship was very organized. It had everything laid out at right angles. In the back part of the ship, there's an area where the barrels are all scattered about. And then I noticed there's a bare spot. There's a bare spot that looks like there was something that the barrels used to be covering. Now, we know from the history books that LaSalle abandoned his ship to try and go find New Orleans. He went on foot. And when he did, he left most of his possessions on the ship, but he took some things with him. Now I'm curious, from a role-playing perspective, I've put myself in the mind of someone actually on that ship. I have a question: why are those barrels there when they should be someplace else? This is a good question for an archaeologist examining the wreck and trying to figure out all the components of the wreck and reconstruct that story. So role-playing not only brought me into history, but it brought people who study history into the role-playing. So they get a little echo, a little mirror, a little window that they couldn't have had otherwise. So as you can guess, I'm a big fan of little maps and little playing pieces to help people visualize where they are in this imaginary world. And the storytelling games have less of an accent on this. The storytelling games also follow a different paradigm of who's in charge. They're very much about sharing who's in charge. So now I was wondering, could you take the control of the continuity? The game master is sort of the sheriff of continuity. The game master in a dice game will say, no, you shouldn't be a Jedi Knight in a Star Trek game. Couldn't you be a Vulcan, maybe? Or a Romulan? Or a Klingon? That's what belongs here. They're the one who enforces the strictness. How do you bring that into a game where everybody is in charge? The storytelling games run by giving people tokens that let that person have the job of making a decision. It may even be a game system where you take turns telling the story, and nobody is in charge except the person who's talking at the time. This seems like a terrible recipe for chaos. This is partly one of the bones of contention why people who do traditional role-playing game descending from Dungeons and Dragons just don't get games like Fiasco. You don't roll dice, you just make it up. To the role player, everyone is the meanie or the genie with no buffer to the culpability. So if it's my turn in a storytelling game, and I have all my fellow players' characters get stuck on a desert island, on the one hand, I've made it an exciting story, but on the other hand, I'm playing the hand of fate, crapping on them. I'm being the meanie. Where are the limits? How far can I go with this? How far can I go? Can I just say, your character has just lost an arm? In a traditional role-playing game, it would be anathema for the game master to use their authority in this way. But in the storytelling games, it's perfectly accepted, because one of the principles of their game is not in-character actions lead to in-character consequences and what happened in the past gives rise to the future. One of their highest principles is have fun. It's your game, it's your character, it's your story. Why are we here? Well, we're here to have our fantasies. We're here for role-playing in the sense of getting away from everyday life and having a win. Or, if you're the masochist, having a terrible, dramatic, heartfelt loss. And that's their main idea, their highest goal. These are not wrong. It's not like the rules of what role-playing is supposed to be have been broken. It's that there's a whole other set of principles that they've chosen to put first. And why is that better in some situations? Well, let's take one situation. You've come home, you've had a hard day, you manage inventory for a living. Your job is suspiciously like what role players do when they buy iron rations and ropes and iron spikes and arrows. And you're not in the mood to play logistics. What you'd like is to be someone glamorous or to be someone in terrible danger. You want to be Kim Kardashian, or you want to be Tom Cruise in impossible mission stories dangling from his rope. And you're not there to build an epic. You're not there to write a Russian novel. You're there to have a great time. You're there to have a shorter story. So these other sets of principles are more helpful to what you might want to do in that situation. But it's still not getting to the question of, can we still have continuity? Can this game take us somewhere? One of the challenges of a role-playing game that's a story game primarily is that nothing in the story happens that was not somehow in one of the players' heads. If the person running the story at the moment says, a bear is wandering around in the woods outside your campsite, well, it's fun because pretty much everybody's going to know a bit about what a bear is. And they're going to have a sense of emotional reaction based on something that you know. But how are you going to get a story like the alien from Aliens, which nobody thought about? Someone had to come up with it first. How do you get something new into your story? Something that's never existed, maybe. When the first Aliens movie came out, the first Alien movie, this horrific thing that comes off an egg, grabs people's faces, puts an egg in their stomach, and then that poor person falls over and something comes bursting out of their chest. Where did that come from? That had to come from somewhere. It probably came from several people putting their heads together and coming up with this. So I started looking for ways to share the genie and meanie idea. And the first things that I found were a storytelling game called Mythic, where you think up things that might be true in the story. There's a limitation. You can only ask a question if your character in the story could reasonably get an answer to that question, given what the story's situation is at the time. Here's an example. You're a police person. There's a body on the ground. You ask, was there a sign of a struggle? In the game Mythic, you decide what the odds are. Let's say that an earlier question had established that there's blood all over the place. Well, in that case, you wouldn't be asking that question. But let's say a previous question had established there's an axe on the ground. And you ask, was there a sign of a struggle? Well, the answer is, could be yes, could be no. So the person playing Mythic, it's a single player storytelling game, says, well, maybe it's 50-50. Or maybe they say, I'm going to say it's 25%. Or it's going to be 90%. It's very subjective. But the more that person wants to have a story that makes sense, the more they'll put effort into setting that statistic, that number, in a way that fits what they know already. And Mythic, while seeming to be the most loosey-goosey kind of role-playing game and storytelling game, is actually the most strict game. It puts the person playing in the position of considering everything that's happened before and thinking, does this possibility make sense? And that's exactly what I do when I'm running a game for other people. So I had stumbled on a way to help other folks find out what it's like to be the storyteller in the game, the role-playing game master. But Mythic was still just one person doing this. So I looked at the computer game and said, can we share this somehow? So I built a little widget in the game that lets everyone, it's almost like a game show, it lets everyone give their opinion on what that number of a yes answer ought to be on a scale of 2 to 20, and then we roll two 10-sided dice and add them up. Now, I was playing this in Killeen with a 9-year-old girl and her cousin, who was about 20. And I let them decide everything about the story when we started. I said, who would you like to be? And the little girl says, policewomen! Okay. And I'm thinking, wow, what have I gotten myself into here? And I'm really thinking this after I asked the question, well, what department are you in? And the little girl pipes up, homicide! Oh boy. All right, well, we can tone this back. We can make this light. Doesn't have to be gory details. There's no rule in role-playing games that says you have to describe everything. We started with a very basic idea that was, you find a body. Very believable thing for homicide detectives to do. And we did pin down in two questions that there was an axe there. And the other lady asks, how is she dressed? Well, one of the rules of the Mythic system was you can only ask yes-no questions. And so between the two of them, they changed it to, is she all the way dressed? Meaning, was she wearing clothes like she had just come home from work? And the answer was so extreme, the dice numbers were so different, it was double zeros. It was a glaring no. That they decided, I didn't have to prompt them, they decided she's wearing her house coat and slippers, and she's got a cloth over her head because she went to sleep, and she was doing her hair, and I was no longer needed. I could have walked out the room and they could have still played, because now they were coming up with the details of what was happening in the world. And one of them would say, well, I think the chance is a 15. And the other would say, I think the chance is a 10. And I came up with a game called Oracle, inspired by Mythic. And the difference is, you take everybody's idea of what that number of a chance of a yes is, and you average it and drop fractions. You don't even have to know what the concept of averaging and dropping fractions is if that widget just says, give me a number, and then a referee in the room who's playing the host pushes a button and it spits out the target number of that chance of a yes. It made a mechanical difference. It made it smoother. And the story unfolded in this game in Killeen, this pickup game, that the woman who was out there in her house coat and her slippers, she was the one carrying the axe because she had heard a noise outside. And the reason that she had been killed was that she had seen something awful that she shouldn't have. She turned out to be not just the victim, but the witness to another crime. And I love to write stories. Every year I take part in the National Novel Writing Month. You were trying to write 50,000 words in 30 days. Well, I do it in 5 days. That's how much I love to write. And I don't think I could have written as fun of a story as those two girls who had never done any kind of role-playing game before had done just then. I would have had a fun time watching that on television, what they were describing. But it still didn't have meaning because it was just a one-shot. But when we were done, the little girl, 9 years old, I think she had an intuitive inkling of this because she said, do we get promoted? So I decided to handle that as an Oracle question. Well, let's see. Do you think you handled the situation well? I think you did. And what's some reasons, yes and no? One of the things I encourage with playing Oracle Online is everybody tries to see the other side of the question. You're not just trying to get your own way, you're bringing up other reasons why things wouldn't be going your way. And in this case, what would be a reason you don't get promoted? They said, well, there could only be so many openings in the department. Maybe we did something wrong before. No, you didn't do any, you didn't mess up any cases that we know of. Okay, let's set it at a 13 or less on two 10-sided dice, add it together, that you get promoted. And they rolled a pair of ones. And we used the extremeness of the dice roll to hint how strong of an answer is sometimes. And so the wrap-up of this story, though it doesn't go on, is the implication they did get promoted with honors. So that's the happy ending to their story. And bringing this back to storytelling, I'm still left with a question of how do you get something new into this? Well, we're just at the beginning of what role-playing is going to be. A lot of folks feel like it's settled and the answers are all there. I feel like we have only scratched the tip of the iceberg. We're playing with dice that are similar to the 20-sided dice that the Romans made in 1000 AD. But we have tablets and pads, and we have the internet, and we can Google. So I took the Mythic game and made it the Oracle game, and then I started playing with trying to find ways to bring new ideas into it. And one of the first games that we got out of it was playing in the world of BPRD. It's a comic book, and you might be familiar with the Hellboy series. It's a couple of movies. He's a foundling who looks like a great big demon, but he's on the side of good. He works for a secret government organization investigating paranormal disturbances. So the way that Mythic gets played, you have a list of words. It's almost like a tarot card program where you roll randomly and let that poke your imagination to where the story's going. And I went to a tabloid headline investigation, and I had it generate me a random tabloid headline to try to get the seed of my story. The seed of the story can be very simple, like you find a dead body. The tabloid headline we got was disturbance at grave site halts construction work. So my random thing there first was something not coming out of my brain, but came out of my computer, was a tabloid headline. Then I asked the question, where did this happen? There is another online service that lets you click a button, and it gives you coordinates anywhere in the world. Well, I said, if it's in the ocean or somewhere frozen like Antarctica, we'll roll again. It gave me coordinates to somewhere in India. Well, now I knew that there was construction work and a grave site and somewhere in India. So I Googled grave site, haunted, and India. And wouldn't you know it, there had been real-life sabotage of construction equipment at a real grave site. So now I was reading, thanks to Google, I was reading an article about how a dam was being built, a river was going to turn an area with a village into the bottom of a lake. And while the people were happy to accept the government stipend for the time and to move their homes and their families and everything they'd known 17 miles away, they were going to have to leave their family grave sites. Their family grave sites could never be visited again. They were going to be at the bottom of this lake. So my character and my friend's character go to this place in India. We can make assumptions like this because we have the continuity that we belong to an organization that would see that we had travel accommodations. And now we're in the position of being the writer saying, well, how do we stop this? We looked up, what do you do with ghosts in India? And we found two answers. The first answer is, a child, a pure child on an elephant, rides it backwards through the town, which makes the misfortune leave because it has to trace the elephant's steps backwards, and then the elephant has to stamp to stop the evil influences. Well, this area was not anywhere near any place where they did elephants and logging, so that option was less likely. And then we found another article that said that on certain holidays, some people in India, in this region, put out a plate of rice with rice balls as an offering, and it said that the rice has to be a certain kind, there have to be certain spices. The ghosts apparently like saffron, which is very expensive, and that the spirits of the dead, if you've done something wrong, like you've married the wrong kind of person in your grandfather's eyes, will be appeased by a rice dinner with saffron. So now the question becomes, did it work? So our characters tried it, and we sat there and thought, well, what are the odds of this ceremony working? If you don't know what the odds are, the default is make it 50-50, make it 11 or less, which is a slightly higher chance of a yes than a no. There are in-character reasons why we would want this to work, of course, and if you're being simulationist, you try not to let that affect it. Just because your character wants the ceremony to work doesn't mean it's going to. But out-of-character reasons are valid, as long as they're not the only reason. And one out-of-character reason could be, it makes dramatic sense. And the opposite is, boy, if that was the answer, that would just be the silliest, cheesiest thing ever. No, we don't want it to be that. So we let the out-of-character druthers color this number in Oracle. So up until this time, no dice had been rolled at all. It had all been Google searches and talking to each other, saying, well, what question do we ask next? So it all came down to only one dice roll in the entire storytelling game, and that was, do the angry ghosts feel appeased by this offering? And I thought, you're about to flood our entire village and never see us again? I'm going to say this is going to be successful on an 8 or less. They might want more, or maybe something else needs to be done. But we rolled the dice, and were they appeased? The answer came up, yes, they were appeased. So that was the end of that story, and the sabotage of the construction equipment by ghosts stopped, and we can assume that the people relocated successfully and that the ancestor spirits were content to be at the bottom of the lake in exchange for the people getting an upgrade. They actually, the real-world people actually got more land than they had owned before this event. So they did get a positive outcome of this in the real world. But this was how we used a storytelling game to take us to places we had never been. We went to India in our imaginations, and to get influence in the story from things that we had never seen. I had never heard of this ceremony of walking an elephant backwards. I had never heard of giving rice balls to your ancestors. And it became clear what we're doing in the storytelling games is just the beginning. There are so many new mechanics that we can apply, and so many gizmos and gadgets that are going to do to storytelling, for storytelling game, what 20-sided dice and 8-sided dice and 12-sided dice and 30-sided dice and 71-sided dice are doing for traditional tabletop role-playing with character sheets. So I'm looking for new storytelling games every convention I go to, and enjoying how the old school games are getting rewritten. They add things like character generation with personal problems as a potential for something you can agree to have your character experience. These developments are constantly coming. I'm very optimistic about this, and I think that the current antipathy of the two camps will lessen when we see that the principles we're going for are not exclusive to one camp or the other. They're just in a different mix, a different balance, for a different optimal outcome. So that's my story of the genie and the meanie, and I have these souvenir booklets which encapsulate the meanie or genie idea. Thank you for coming to listen to me today, and welcome to Celesticon. I hope the rest of your convention is far more exciting.
Yeah, today was, actually, I played one of the stricter, we played Tunnels and Trolls.
Basically. Yeah, Tunnels and Trolls is famous for a fumble chart where you shoot yourself in the leg and you lose a leg from a one botched arrow shot.
Yeah.
It's infamous for a very harsh outcome.
Yep. We just got done playing that, like, when you guys came in, and that was, so I happened to think.
Was it a classic dungeon crawl? What the characters
actually
set up?
We did a, it was more like wandering, like wilderness, dungeon crawl in the wilderness. So we basically fought two bears, and then we killed a dragon. We hunted a dragon down. That was terrifying.
Bears could eat none of those.
Yeah, I know. We actually, like, it's funny because I'm so used to games that there's, like, a story, you know, you're getting attacked and you gotta go and, like, there's sort of a beginning, the middle, the end. And this one was more the, almost like the sandbox, because we just, like, decided what we were gonna do. We went and killed the bears as a demonstration of how combat works in the system. And then we decided, oh, we're gonna skin them with our wildlife skill and then sell them. And, like, use their bear claws to create, like, gloves with claws on them and use them to punch people.
Oh, that's cool.
But, yeah, it was just fun. I haven't done, like, the freestyle, like, sandbox in, like, I don't know how long. So, yeah, it's that was pretty nice. But it just made me think of that. Yeah,
I like Tunnels and Trolls. I like the game system.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. I personally, like, I experiment with different systems. Like, I do GURPS, I do Vampire the Masquerade, I do...
Do you do LARPing?
I don't do LARPing.
I used to run a VTM LARP with Guru, and this was the very first edition, so the most wonky and chaotic we had. When we got to about 120 people, we started getting FBI agents. And they would come and just to check out what is this organization, what kind of flavor does it have, is there potential for violence, is there potential for nuttiness here, what is this role-playing game thing? And of the folks who came through, one of them decided to just stick with it, and he became one of our best players for a couple of years.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, that was rather cool. No, I've never done LARPing. I've always been curious. I mean, I've come close.
They may have a very, very, very light role-playing LARP here for the Bethorm game. For it's Tekemel. It's a setting.
Oh,
Bethorm is our take
that.
On it, but Tekemel is that. That's like Bronze Age Egyptian, as if Egyptians had re-evolved in space.
Okay.
Because I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think I inadvertently listed that, not knowing it was a LARP. But that's fine. that's interesting.
I'll show you another thing I'm working on. This is, you get the sneak preview because you came to the convention. The game we came here with last year was Cavemaster. Cavemaster is...
That's what I heard about. I saw that.
It's played with these rocks. We steal these from the playground. We make little bags and we carry them. We did this as a Kickstarter, and the people who backed us each got a little bag.
Oh, nice.
Each got a little bag with an arrowhead and some pebbles and things like that. You got your mojo bag.
Wow.
And I decided I was going to do a game in Michigan, and I called it Dark Future Saga, which is the Cavemaster Pebbles resolution when you need a conflict resolution. But we take this take this paper. And it turns out that if you take a piece of paper and you make a slit in the center, like this, you fold it like this, it turns into a little book.
Huh.
So all the equipment for doing the role-playing games, like the printed out maps and the beautiful pewter figures, while those are wonderful, what people who are starting really need is the least amount of rules and to understand the principles. Understand the principles so they'll know, well, when do we follow these rules and when do we say, you know, this is just not going to work for us. We're going to need a variant, or we're going to throw this out entirely and come up with something new.
Yeah.
So I'll be running... This is a disaster happens and you're in Michigan. It's going to be a... Instead of 10,000 years ago, it's set 3,000 years in the future. And this is the player booklet. So your character generation has been put on a little book like that.
Oh, nice. That's pretty cool.
So that's what we're doing. Are you going to run?
No, they were doing that. I had to fill out something, so I was going to listen to the... but I'm in the wrong room.
Is it Genie and Meanie?
Yeah.
Here.
Here is
the core of what I'm saying. It's your souvenir book. Thanks for coming. You just missed it.
Yeah.
And, the idea is, with storytelling games, the top principle you're following is... It's your game, it's your character, have a good time.
Right.
And with strict role-playing and the traditional tabletop that comes out of Dungeons & Dragons, the top principle is there's continuity, and what happened in the past gives rise to the present, gives rise to the future, and when you have all these things like rule books and character sheets, what you're doing is you're putting a thumbtack in, you're pinning down the continuity. When I play Flashing Blades, the Musketeers game, I make a character who fits the 1600s in France. And I don't violate continuity by playing a Doctor Who character or a Vulcan in the Musketeer era. And if you're doing the improv-like storytelling games, there is totally nothing wrong with having Doctor Who show up
Amber.
In a game. Yeah, an Amber game. And then I talked very briefly about Oracle, that's based on an older game called Mythic. We're sharing the game master chores of what really happens by rolling 2d10, adding them together, and getting a number that answers a yes-no question. You can only ask the question if your characters in the scene could reasonably come up with the answer to that. That's what keeps it role-playing. If you could ask any question at all, then you're just doing cooperative fiction telling, and that's not wrong. That's a wonderful thing. But what makes it feel more like role-playing is when you're limited in scope to what the characters can try to do. And with Oracle, that setting of the number is not done by one person. The whole group does it. So we ask a question like, you found a body. Has there been a sign of a struggle? And have a real brief discussion and say, okay, on a 13 or less, there was a struggle. We roll some dice. No, there was no sign of a struggle. All right, brainstorm. Why is this body here? So one question can lead to the next. And these are the kinds of mechanics that will bring storytelling into new territory.
Yeah, that's almost no longer... It's like freeform. You're telling a story freeform.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's a comedy sports game like that. You start telling a story and then you stop and he continues the story and then he continues the story.
Yeah.
But there's nobody in charge of the story.
Right,
the
you're
story
sharing it.
Can go everywhere. Which is a way to do it except for one person, one broken cog, somebody whose intellect or IQ isn't as high as others, will drag parts of that down into the basement, and then another one might raise it up to a high you can't understand what they're talking about. So that's I see the only problem with that.
Like, and not everybody's a great game master running Dungeons & Dragons. somebody there might be totally sadistic and just be there to give everybody a terrible time. Well, what I'm going for in telling people about the genie or the meanie, the two principles of being a game master, in order to have a fun storytelling game, I'm hoping if more people become better game masters, then it's something you're all doing.
Yeah.
You all learn about this process. It's not just one person. So that's what that little booklet's for.
Okay. I have it. I'll read it during one of my games.
Okay.
But I mean, you're not going to be getting other games, so I figured, right?
I'm going to be running one tomorrow and one on Sunday. And they're both going to be using the pebbles.
Pebbles?
Yeah.
Ship.
Oh, that's...
Meeples? Are those meeples or are those...
Okay.
Two decks.
These are pebbles, not meeples. I adore meeples.
Some games are the meeple games and some are the...
I made this in cooperation with someone who works at a museum named Michael Pearson. They brought up the Wreck of La Belle. 300 years ago, it sank off the coast of Texas. The official story is that LaSalle was off course. The accusation by the Spaniards is that he was a spy intending to attack the silver mines in Mexico. He was supposed to go to Louisiana. What was he doing near Corpus Christi off the coast of Texas, near the mouth of the Rio Grande? Very suspicious. So one of the clues when I was doing this map is I replicated where all the boxes and barrels were found on the actual wreck. The front half, everything was very intact. You could find remnants of rope, so they know this was all still lashed down. The front half looks very organized. It's all at regular right angles. Everything is stacked the way it should be. The aft hold is in disarray. Specifically, there's a gap. It looks like something was on the ground there, and they moved stuff away. Now here's another clue that they found in the wreck. These little spheres, they look like fire pots. Fire pots are clay jugs filled with flammable oil and a powder charge, black powder. You would light the wick, and you'd lob it onto the deck of the other ship.
Right.
So it's only really useful as a defensive weapon, because you can't fire these like you can a cannonball. They're not an offensive weapon, they're a defensive weapon. They don't go very far. And it takes time for them to act. But of course you would have the enemy sailors scrambling, the enemy marines scrambling to put out a fire on deck. Holy crap. If we get that away from the sails, we are so screwed if we lose our sails. And these, when they x-rayed them, did not contain just powder. They contained 8-centimeter iron spheres with more gunpowder inside. This was the 1600s, so...
Secondary explosion.
He was carrying a load of about 15 grenades. And back then, that would have been high tech. This black powder technology was only 50 years old in France. So here's this guy, he's way off course by about 300 miles, and he's carrying grenades that can't possibly be used to fight another ship. He is loaded for bear, and there are no bears at sea. He's up to something. So he was murdered by his own men later on, and it may be that there was someone in the crew or someone following them that did it. So there were all these factions at work, and but I would never have had that insight without actually going back and doing this map. And I was talking to people who are the archaeologists looking at this, and through role-playing game techniques, they're putting themselves in the mind of someone walking around on the ship, going down the stairs. Okay, I can walk here, I can walk here, I can walk over here. And the back of the ship here was, another thing that was interesting about this is they had converted it into a little tiny kitchen. Everything was soggy, they weren't worried about it. I think they had like run out of cigarettes and they were having their last few pipefuls of tobacco and kind of huddling in the back, you know, getting the most of it by everybody smoking the pipeful when one person was and talking and having their stew. I'm going to be using this in a game with Cave Master pieces, and the game is called The French Invade Cave Master. There's a free game you can get called The French Invade Texas, which is a role-playing game about... It's a historical role-playing game just about LaSalle's last voyage on La Belle on this ship. But having once made this, we can publish this and sell this, and it's really easy for it to be printed out. It's 1 inch to 5 feet, which just fits on a piece of paper. I couldn't have asked for a more appropriately sized deck than this ship. It's almost like they knew I was going to be printing it on standard 8.5 by 11s on a color printer. They just made it for me. I also did, just for fun, see if I have it in here, made these.
Da Vinci wings?
Exactly. So if you don't want to play historical, you put your...
With runic symbols?
You can put
wings?
Your magic-powered sailing wings and construct it as a flying ship.
Dirigible, yeah.
An airship with a PPE at the end. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Thanks.
Multi-game. Multifaceted. A little steampunk there in the end. Go from...
Yeah. And this is where role-play games taking people is. It's taking me into history where, for the fun and for the excitement, I can make use of a real archaeological survey's map and convert it into something for gaming. And I can take the archaeologists back into the hold of the ship to realize, at an emotional level, something's funny on this ship. Something funny was going on here. Here's where they pushed the barrels over hastily. You can tell. You can tell they didn't carry them over to the other side. They said, get those barrels out of there, and whatever's there, get that up to the deck. And I would not have, I don't think I would have seen that from just photos of the, of the wreck, and aerial photos after they had excavated it. I don't think I would have had that insight until I looked at the role-playing map.
Oh, sorry, I missed your presentation.
Welcome to Celestic Gardens.
Pretty cool props, huh?
Thank you. You know what this is? This is a replica of something found aboard the ship.
It's almost a sextant.
It's kind of. It's nocturnal. You look through the hole at the North Star, and then you point this little bit to the Great Bear, or this to the Little Bear, and then you move this around, and you put this to today's date. There's a calendar on the edge. On the back side is a list of risings of stars. And I used a little program on computer to show me the sky at sunrise when you're in London, because this is in English, it was probably made around London. And I asked the computer to show me the skies when you're in Houston, in Corpus Christi. And a funny thing happens on the way to the forums is that when you're in London, these risings follow the clock fairly well. The sailors would not be using instruments like this. Everybody would know that when the whale's tail comes up over the horizon, it's the next shift. So get your lazy arse on deck and let me have the hammock. But imagine that they're sailing south, and somewhere as they're passing the latitude of Florida, they're realizing one of the shifts is now 3 hours long, and one of the shifts is now half hour long. It would have felt very strange, lifelong habits, and this something as fundamental as your clock, it would feel like time was shifting. Obviously, the sailors would have known, well, no, it's not time shifting, it's just because of the way the stars are positioned. They would have known that that's why it's happening, but it doesn't change the fact that it would have thrown, if this was how they were setting their shifts, it would have thrown them into chaos. So maybe that's why they bumped the captain off, and maybe that's why the people, maybe that's why they were, you know, maybe that's why they were 200 miles off course.
Interesting.
So I'm going to toss that into the role-playing game and let the players...
See where it goes?
Yeah, see, okay. I'm gonna see what they make of it.
Well, good luck with it.
Thanks.
I mean, at least it's got...
a theme, a concept. You can see a lot of work in it, which is always good when you see the GM, you know, spending some time on it. So
it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. Enjoy the con.
Thank you.